Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I have with me the author who on his book covers is called B. Catling, whose name is Brian Catling. He is the author most well known for a trilogy of books. They are remarkable. They have been called fantasy by people who write and read fantasy, like Alan Moore, but they're no more fantasy than you and I are fantastic, although perhaps we are. I'm a very lucky bookworm because over the many years I've had very valuable assistants, one of whom, Anthony Miller, recommended a book called The Vorr. V-O-R-R-H. I must tell you, I resisted it. Flannery O'Connor said that she didn't like things that looked funny on the page. I don't like words that look like they're not in my language if they're not in some other. So The Vorr sat on my shelf. It was published first in England. A second volume of it, called The Erstwhile, came out and was published both in England and in America by Vintage Books. And then a third volume, The Cloven, came out in both countries. And I have to say that slowly but surely, I found the books involving and remarkable and strange. Sometimes I didn't know what was happening in them. Sometimes they were even better because I went from not knowing what was happening to suddenly knowing and then back again. Is this a sort of reasonable response to this trilogy, Brian Catling?
I think it's a very reasonable response to it, but I think it's like the forest itself. The Vorr is a forest. It's a fictional forest. But it's so dense and it's so large, it can never be known. And of course, you can become entangled in it.
Entangled is one of the words. Lost in it, bewildered by it, snarled in it. I found it, in all of its aspects, thrilling. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you taught yourself many things about writing in the writing of it, so that sometimes we read things that you would not have done again in the third volume, in the first volume.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting to watch a world come into being by a writer who is also an artist and a performance artist, a sculptor, who's learning how to do what he does as he does it right in front of you. What is it like to learn your art as you make it?
I've always written poetry, and I've always thought prose is something I can't do. And I had the first scene in my head. I had it very clearly in my head where the man makes a bow from the dead body of his wife. And I tried this over 6 years to write. Got to page 3, threw it away. And I can't do this. This is not what I do. And then something clicked. And it was instigated. And then I started to write more and more. I was waking up earlier and earlier in the morning, and it just started to flow, and it entered a condition where I was a participant. I wasn't controlling it. I was looking forward to waking up to start it because I didn't know what was going to happen next.
Well, you see, I think one of the magnificent things about the Vor, which is the name of the trilogy, as well as the name of the first volume of the trilogy, the Erstwhile is Volume 2, the Coven is Volume 3. With each volume, there's what I would, for lack of a better term, call a tutelary genius. That in Volume 1, that tutelary genius is Raymond Roussel. In Volume 2, the genius teacher is Edward Muybridge.
And Blake.
And Blake, yes. And in Volume 3...
It's Eugene Marais.
Yes. And again, just as I'm grateful to Anthony Miller for introducing me to the Vor and Brian Catling's work, Anthony, I might add, is now the proud father of a child named Astra.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that wonderful? Yes. John Ashbery introduced me to the work of Raymond Roussel, most famously, Impressions of Africa. Roussel was a wealthy woman's son who would write and publish his own novels. Those novels, once they were published, of course, to a incomprehensible lack of fanfare, he'd make them into plays, and the plays would bore people so much that they would have riots. This had become, by now, a typical thing in French theater, the riot at the end of the play that you disapprove of. But he wrote Impressions of Africa, later New Impressions of Africa, without ever having been to Africa.
Purposefully.
Purposefully, yes. But also, it's not only that, on some level, he's interested in what Africa means to him, not what Africa means to Mungo Park, not what Africa means to you. He's interested not even in what Africa means in his dreams. He's interested in what Africa means when its words play together with sufficiently interesting rules that they form a continent.
And it's a frame.
Yes.
It's a frame in which extraordinary things occur. I mean, the Vor, the word, the title of the book is the name of the forest, and it's his forest. He named it. It doesn't exist, but he created this thing. But I found something else. I think I got that word from Raymond Roussel, and I think he got it from Edgar Allan Poe.
It wouldn't surprise
because
me one
bit. Because
in
Poe, I think it's in The Descent into Maelstrom, we're not quite sure which, there's a landmass called Vur. V-U-U-R.
Oh.
So there's a fantasy place, or a place, not fantasy is the wrong word, there's a place of imagination and impossibility that is so big, so impossible, anything can occur there. But Roussel never talked about the forest once. He had no interest in it. It was just an occurrence where people did things.
Yes. And I think one day, B. Catling, Brian Catling, woke up and thought, what if in the middle of this unfathomable forest, it should turn out that the Garden of Eden is still sitting there with the tree of knowledge and the fruit of the wonder of good and evil? What if they're there still? The forest is too dense.
Or the stump of it.
Yes. Yes. But imagine my, what would you say, shock and joy awe and surprise when, toward the end of volume two, the book talking to you says, "What was the fruit of the tree of good and evil for? If it wasn't for Adam, he wasn't supposed to eat it, and not for the angels that guard the tree, they're not supposed to eat it either. Not for God, God knows good and evil, or we think he might. What is this fruit for?" And the answer comes in one line, because frequently this book is full of mystical one-liners. "The fruit of good and evil is for the other trees." Oh, yes. And they don't have to bite it.
No.
It's in their root system. It is the forest. The forest is an emanation, an exfoliation of good and evil. That is to say, if you'll allow me, Brian is writing a book where all art is growing out of the center of the forest, which is generating distinctions, good and evil, that cannot be made but become more forest.
Exactly. But also, it also undermines everything that's ever been made by a human being, any human thought, any human condition, the arrogance we have even talking, by simply saying, you know what, all this may never have been for you. The fact that Adam did that, that men grew in a certain way, that humanity became a condition that ignores most of everything else while looking after itself, that it was never meant for you. Something went wrong. Humanity is a kind of cancer that happened accidentally.
I'm talking to B. Catling, Brian Catling, the author of a trilogy that some regard as fantasy. I don't. He doesn't, but some of its guardians, like Alan Moore, the creator of Watchmen, some great fantasists have co-opted the book, so maybe you want to read it as fantasy. I would say read it despite the fact that even after reading, what, nearly 1,500 pages, I couldn't tell you what it is. I can tell you, among other things, that a Cyclops who's wanted badly to have a second eye gets it and realizes that it's not right for him and digs it out. I can tell you, if you want to know, that it has as many chases and quests as any great Beowulf-like story or any superhero movie, if you want it that way. It's a book that will cooperate with your desires for it. And that was interesting to me, too. How did you do that? Write a book where so many of its demands remain ambivalent.
It's another way of saying it may be the way to answer. People say that people have a problem with it because there's no truly good people or truly bad people in it. People change condition all the time.
And
that's what it is. It's a series of changing conditions. That's why it's proving almost impossible for anyone to even consider how to make it as a film or as a TV series.
Because
there's a desperate hunger. There's a desperate hunger for something new, something that is kind of like this, that can go into this space in the film and television world that isn't Game of Thrones. I like Game of Thrones enormously, but it isn't that. But people see that this might be it, and then they ask me, tell me, I'm sure it is like Game of Thrones, but tell me what it is. And I can't answer them in one sentence or on one sheet of paper.
You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking with Brian Catling, about the trilogy The Vor. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with the remarkable Brian Catling about the series The Vor Trilogy. Some say it's a fantasy novel, but it transcends genre and brings the reader in with not just captivating prose, but the idea that we are, all of us, the inventions of some other kind of writer. These three books, The Vor, The Erstwhile, and The Cloven, a trilogy, have tutelary teaching geniuses, and that in the second volume, it's, I think, you say Blake, but I think even more Muybridge.
Yeah, yeah.
The style of the writing.
Yes.
The
yes.
sentences.
Yes.
There's a scene I couldn't believe. We go to a bedlam, and there are people who've come back from World War I, and all they can do is repeat themselves.
Yes.
And the writing does what they do.
Yes.
The writing
yes.
is like Muybridge's photography. And suddenly, these two of a trio are imitating each other so constantly, shambling, stumbling, that they seem like Charlie Chaplin, and the psychologist visiting them can't stop laughing because they are hilarious. They're not pathetic. They are something that has not existed before Chaplin existed, but here they are, frightened by war.
Terrifying,
reduced
right?
yeah. to endless repetition. And the writing does it too. This isn't Gertrude Stein. This is its own form of repetition. May I say that Muybridge was the genius who was able to prove that when a horse is galloping, there are times when the horse's legs, all four of them, are not on the ground. Is that to say that the horse is flying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And there's even some doubt now that he may have changed some of the images in that photograph by hand to make it even more clear that it did that, even if it didn't.
Yes.
He had a wonderful technique in his landscape pictures. Especially in the evening, he would cut a hole out of the negative, so the moon was always there as a white dot.
What we know to be true, the truth is a highly manipulable thing.
There is also a film made of survivors from First World War who are undergoing psychiatric treatment of a kind, and you can see them, you can see these movements, and the reason they're being filmed is to show that they can be then sent back from the very thing that's turned them into this repeating breakdown situation, so they can put a gun in the hand and send them straight back into it.
Yes. Yes, in this case, the word bomb
yes.
is the trigger.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
go running under the bed and have an instinct to bury themselves.
And that is true. That there were cases of people who actually did that.
The third volume, which is called The Coven, has as its teaching genius a writer who I happened to discover by accident, who I, well, when I have young writers who I want to cause to sprout brilliantly, rapidly, insanely, I recommend the writer named Eugene Marais. He was an African writer. He wrote, among other things, although his poetry is famous, very little of it has been translated.
Exactly.
He's written short stories, some of which have been translated, but the books you want, the books you will never forget, the two books, one is called The Soul of the Ape, and the other is called The Soul of the White Ant. The white ant is what they used to call termites. And to write about animals as having souls, and since we know about certain animals, about many animals, most animals, they're capable of love, not just for one another, but for us. And yet no one has written about their souls, and no one has written really convincingly about our souls.
Nobody dares.
Nobody dares except Eugene Marais, M-A-R-A-I-S.
And the books were in Afrikaans, which is an even more obscure language, to such a degree that The Soul of the White Ant is a wonderful book, but it's entirely stolen by the philosopher Maeterlinck.
Wait. It's worse. Maeterlinck was not a philosopher. He was a playwright.
Yeah, he's a playwright.
He wrote The Bluebird, which eventually became a Shirley Temple movie.
It did. But serve him right.
Yes, it did serve him right. In Lolita, the name Maeterlinck is mentioned, and Humbert says, Maeterlinck Schmaeterlinck, which means Maeterlinck butterfly.
Fantastic.
The world is composed of a great circuit of meaning, constantly connected and reconnected. That's what these books are for. The meaning of Brian Catling's book is contained within the book and outside the book as well. It's a fascinating thing to discover a writing style generated by the paranoid war fever. People didn't used to come back from wars marred for life. Yet we can learn from the not recovery.
And also we can learn from the injured and from those who are not apparently in a state of normal condition. Eugene Marais being one of those himself. I mean, he was a lawyer by trade, but he was also a morphine addict. And one with all of those confusions, with a really complicated existence, he found the clarity to watch an ant, to see what it did, and to see what it might mean.
I found Eugene Marais. There used to be a literary magazine called Antaeus from a press called Echo Press. Each issue had a list of the neglected masterpieces of the 20th century. Amazing that over so brief a time we generated so many neglected masterpieces. That's how I found my Eugene Marais. How did you find him?
Just before I answer that, can I tell you that was my ambition for the Vore? I thought it would be a neglected masterpiece. I never expected it to be successful. I thought I was writing a surrealistic epic, which is a contradiction in terms, and that sometime in 25 years from now, someone would find the manuscript on a shelf and say, this is quite interesting. I never expected it to turn into this. I found Marais. I was looking at pictures of ants and animal behaviour, and like a lot of other things, there was an obvious blank. There was an obvious territory that nobody knew or would talk about a certain way. It's the same with trees. It's the same about the intelligence and the consciousness of trees. For a long time, people have never been able to speak about this. Now they're talking about it. And his name came up almost as an insult that there is this minor poet who has a theory about the soul of an ant.
The soul. Yes, thank goodness.
Indeed.
I was talking about the soul one day on this program, Bookworm, and I actually got responses because we're still living in backward times. How can you talk about the soul? Do you actually believe the soul exists? And I want to say, of course the soul exists. I mean, why would you want to not believe in the soul? Why would you want to be part of a time that does not believe in the soul? Well, we'll get back to that subject because this is the first of a two-part show because these books are a trilogy. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I've been talking with Brian Catling on the cover, B. Catling, author of the Vore trilogy, published in America by Vintage. Thank you, Brian, for joining me.
My pleasure.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. Our technical director today, filling in for Mario Diaz, is Philip Richards. Special thanks also to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again when we continue our talk with B. Catling next week on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when B. Catling is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.